Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 216, Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 3. This supplements For the Record Program 214 and an earlier For the Record program done in early 1998. Once again, we're going to talk about the book The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by former military officer and Justice Department investigator John Loftus and his co-author Mark Ahrens. The book was published in hardcover and softcover by St. Martin's Press and copyright 1994. We're going to resume with the first couple of paragraphs of what we were talking about and reading from in the last half-hour segment. This to resume the thread of discussion for those stations that only air a half hour of For the Record each week. Now, once again, we've been talking about Jack Philby, the renegade British intelligence agent turned fascist, Ibn Saud, the Wahhabi chieftain whom he elevated to the position of King of Saudi Arabia, their collaboration with the Third Reich, with major American oil companies such as Texaco and Caltex and Standard Oil, as we will see, and in turn how this laid the foundation for not only the modern Saudi Arabian and Middle Eastern oil structure, but also how collaboration between these industrial and financial elements of Wall Street with the Third Reich and with Saudi oil interests basically resulted in treason during World War II and the blackmailing of the United States and Britain. Loftus and Ahrens write, "To put it simply, in 1940 there was a three-way deal. Jack Philby represented the Saudi sellers of oil, Alan Dulles represented the Nazi buyers such as I.G. Farben, while John Foster Dulles represented the German bankers and Spanish financiers." By the way, I.G. Farben is the Nazi chemical cartel spoken of in numerous programs available from Spitfire. On paper, the Texas Oil Company, Texaco, was the principal supplier of Franco's oil during the Spanish Civil War. In addition, Texaco had become partners with SoCal, which controlled Saudi oil through Jack Philby. The result of this union was Caltex, which was largely the making of James Forrestal. As will be seen in Chapter 7, Forrestal served as Secretary of the Navy and later U.S. Defense Secretary. He played a key role in shaping U.S. oil policy after the war, until paranoid anti-Semitism brought about his premature demise as a political leader. In the 1930s, Forrestal was head of the New York investment bank Dillon Reed. He was an ally of the Dulles brothers and a member of the Wall Street financial mafia. In early 1936, Forrestal brought SoCal and Texaco together and, with the help of Dillon Reed Vice President Paul Nitze, drew up the scheme to pool the assets of the two companies east of Suez. The result was that after 1940, when the deal was formalized, Caltex became the parent company of Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company. The wheel was supposed to be The wheel was beginning to return to where it had been before 1911, when the U.S. Supreme Court had broken up the Rockefellers' oil cartel, Standard Oil. The result of the breakup had been a sometimes genuine and sometimes even fierce competition between the various independent companies that had once been Standard Oil. Aramco eventually would reunite two of the most important companies, Standard of California and Standard of New Jersey, which still was dominated by the Rockefellers in the form of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. The two companies had more in common than oil and greed. They both did business with the Nazis, acting as if they hated the Jews. And I would also note here that SoCal and Texaco were brought together with the help of Dillon Reed Vice President Paul Nitze. Later, he was called upon by George Bush, when he was head of the CIA, to draw up the Plan B analysis of Soviet strategic capabilities, which was much more alarming and which led, along with the oil fraud that we spoke about in For the Record Program 214, to the massive arms buildup of the Reagan administrations and the consequent bankrupting of the United States. Returning once again to this particular collaboration between Philby, Ibn Saud, Saudi Arabia, Wall Street, and Big Oil, and the Third Reich, we read, speaking of the two standard companies, they also had a common shareholder, I.G. Farben. The Dulles brothers' client, Hermann Schmitz, president of American I.G., owned stock in both SoCal and Standard of New Jersey. American IG later changed its name to General Anilin and Film, or GAF, and Forrestal was recruited into the board of the new company. In fact, GAF stock in SoCal and Standard was effectively controlled by its parent company, IG Farben. And what we're going to do now is to take a look very briefly at another book entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by the heroic journalist Paul Manning. We've spoken about him in numerous programs available from Spitfire, and in his discussion of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, by the way, that book published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart and copyright 1981, he discusses that the Bormann Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, and what one banker described as the most important concentration of money power under a single control in world history, how the Bormann Organization, among its many, many economic assets, appears to have accumulated, in fact has accumulated, according to For the Record Program 152, the stock in Standard Oil. And we're going to talk about this right now. And again, of the profound role of IG Farben and its chairman, Hermann Schmitz, in the Standard companies, including Standard Oil of New Jersey, and in turn, the acquisition of this capital participation by the Bormann Organization, we read as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Again, this book authored by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. Of the Bormann, Schmitz, IG Farben, Standard Oil relationship, we read, "The Bormann Organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America and, through stock holdings, controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers." So again, note that the Bormann Organization acquired the Hermann Schmitz Trust, and that basically, recapping the last couple of sentences here, "The Dulles Brothers' client, Hermann Schmitz, president of American IG, owns stock in both SoCal and Standard of New Jersey. American IG later changed its name to General Anilin and Film, or GAF, and Forrestal was recruited to the board of the new front company. In fact, GAF stock in SoCal and Standard was effectively controlled by its parent company, IG Farben." So bear in mind the Bormann Group's profound role in the Standard companies to this day. That the Manning book published in 1981. Continuing, "When the dust settled on the complex web of paperwork, Dulles' Nazi client, IG Farben, had Forrestal on its payroll, while Forrestal's American client, Caltex, had the Saudi oil. The man who held the deal together on the ground was Jack Philby. Through his client, Ibn Saud, a cozy deal could be done to get the Third Reich's hands on Saudi Arabian oil and make lots of money for Dulles' and Forrestal's clients. Ibn Saud was in turn secretly in partnership with the Nazis, who financed his clandestine war against the Zionists in Palestine. The whole arrangement worked well until the United States joined the war in 1941. Then it began to unravel through the Rockefeller end of the oil business, and Standard of New Jersey's relationship with Standard of New Jersey's relationship with Farben had not gone unnoticed in Washington. As previously discussed, next to the Rockefellers, IG Farben owned the largest share of stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey. Among other things, Standard had provided Farben with its synthetic rubber patents and technical knowledge, while Farben had kept its patents to itself under the strict instructions of the Nazi government. For the United States, the results were calamitous, unquote, especially after Pearl Harbor. Standard's deal with the Nazis looked awfully like treason. Senator Harry Truman certainly thought so when he read Standard's 1939 letter renewing its agreement, which made it clear that the Rockefellers' company was prepared to work with the Nazis, whether their own government was at war with the Third Reich or not. Truman's Senate Committee on the National Defense was outraged and began to probe into the whole scandalous arrangement, much to the discomfort of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Suddenly, however, the whole matter was dropped. There was a reason for Rockefeller's escape: blackmail. According to the former intelligence officers we interviewed on this point, The blackmail was simple and powerful. The Dulles brothers had one of their clients threaten to interrupt the U.S. oil supply during wartime. Besides the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, three other members of the U.S. intelligence community insist that Alan Dulles was personally behind the threat to cut off Saudi supplies to a nation already suffering gasoline rationing. There is evidence to corroborate much of what they allege, including the direct participation of an American oil company in the scheme. On February 27, 1942, Thurman Arnold, the Assistant Attorney General of the United States, stormed into the offices of Standard of New Jersey at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York and outlined the charges of acting against the best interests of their own government. Arnold demanded fines totaling $1.5 million and control of the Nazi patents. In response, the Standard executives made it clear that the entire U.S. war effort was fueled by their oil, and it could be stopped. Arnold could do nothing but accept the fact of the blackmail. The American government had no choice but to go along if it wanted oil to win the war. One Standard executive paid $1,000, or a quarter of 1 week's salary, for having betrayed the United States. No matter what they did during the war, Dulles' and Forrestal's clients could get away with anything as long as they controlled the Arabian oil wells. That point was driven home by SoCal, just as the Allied forces were preparing for the invasion of Normandy. The company demanded profit margins of 250% to 300% on production costs for each barrel of Saudi oil sold to the American government. The U.S. government had no choice. It gave SoCal its price increase. And bear in mind that in addition to the IG Farben and Hermann Schmitz and later Bormann participation in Standard Oil of New Jersey, they also participated in SoCal. Bear that in mind for present reference, going back to the World War II period. It was bad enough that U.S. companies could extort such huge profits from the government while continuing to make profits on the other side of the war. Apparently under duress, President Roosevelt also was forced to appoint Alan Dulles' oil cronies to the very boards that were charged with the oversight of such misconduct. Burton Hirsch, in his powerful work The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA, describes an instance where I.G. Farben was concerned that the U.S. alien property custodian might seize the assets of its U.S. subsidiary, General Anilin, in film. Dulles had nothing to worry about, as he had his Wall Street friends on both sides of the dispute. James Forrestal was registered as vice president of General Anilin, controlled by the Farben management. The alien property custodian, Leo Crowley, was on the payroll of the New York J. Henry Schroeder Bank, General Anilin's depository, where Foster and Alan Dulles both sat as board members. Foster arranged an appointment for himself as special legal counsel for the alien property custodian, while simultaneously representing another Farben subsidiary against the custodian. That again from for Burton Hirsch's The Old Boys, The American Elite, and the Origins of the CIA. Back to the Loftus and Aaron's text. Forrestal, it should be noted, had been taken on board by President Roosevelt as his special assistant in 1940 and then promoted to Undersecretary of the Navy, a key post for U.S. government oil interests. No wonder British intelligence went wild over the Dulles' machinations to protect Farben's interests. A lengthy British intelligence report of covert activities against the Nazi American connection was finally released to the press in 1989. It is a marvelously cynical document, replete with instances of subtle British manipulation of the American press during World War II. One of the first targets of the British Secret Service was Gerhard Alois Westrick, the frontman for Sullivan and Cromwell's former German clients. Westrick remained Alan Dulles' personal client before and after the war. Westrick was also a German intelligence agent and in close contact with the pro-Hitler oil man Torkil Reber, a Norwegian-American who was the president of Texaco, as well as SoCal's partner in Saudi oil and one of Forrestal's clients. Reber was among the first Americans to start shipping oil to Franco in the Spanish Civil War. President Roosevelt ordered his activities stopped, but Reber got around this by making a deal with Mussolini's fascists to ship the oil via Italy to Germany. State Department archives show that on August 2, 1940, A Texaco employee denounced Reber as one of Hitler's secret representatives in the United States. By the way, Torkel Reber is R-I-E-B-E-R, his last name. Gerhard Westrick, W-E-S-T-R-I-C-K. Beginning again, State Department archives show that on August 2, 1940, a Texaco employee denounced Reber as one of Hitler's secret representatives in the United States. In addition, according to the employee, most of Texaco's leadership was, quote, pro-Nazi and openly boasts of it, as well as being willing to do all within its power to injure the English and help the Germans, unquote. Texaco, like several of the other U.S. oil companies, was selling oil to the Axis via international cutouts. Things became a little too embarrassing, especially when the press started picking up the story. Still, the company might have gotten away with it, except that Reber dismissed the problem by simply saying that he, quote, considered it good business, unquote. In the wake of the scandal, Texaco's head, James Moffat, quote, found it wise public relations, unquote, to sack Reber as chairman, again quoting, because of his Nazi associations, unquote. In a letter to the president of Standard of California, Moffat expressed sadness over the Reber episode, unquote, but assured his partner in Saudi Oil that there has been no repercussion upon our business throughout the British Empire, unquote. The British oil men were very understanding. Profits came before politics, not to mention the war effort. Unfortunately, there were some patriots among the British establishment. One faction of British intelligence exposed Westrick's shady activities to their agents and sub-agents among American journalists. It was only the opening shot in the British propaganda war. The next British target was I.G. Farben itself. This was a bit too close to home for the Dulles brothers. As one sat on the board of directors and the other handled Farben's litigation up until 1942. As the British intelligence file shows, the Dulles boys wasted no time in pressuring the British to call off their pet dogs in the American press. Here is the classified British version of how they were blackmailed into silence. Quote, Dulles and a colleague expressed their desire to have our British propaganda action in the USA, as far as I.G. Farben is concerned, discontinued. Their explanation of this was that, in their opinion, this might involve large American companies like Standard Oil of New Jersey, etc., thereby perhaps impairing the war effort, unquote. To put it bluntly, Dulles was personally threatening to cut off Britain's supply of oil during the war if the British persisted with their exposé of the American oil connection to I.G. Farben. Dulles had now used the oil blackmail tactic on both sides of the Atlantic with the same outcome. London and Washington bit their tongues. Skipping down, by war's end, Washington had replaced London as Ibn Saud's closest ally and protector. Alan Dulles and his friend Jack Philby had collaborated to bring it all about. Philby was no mere fascist propagandist, and did much more than make speeches and write fanatical newspaper articles. Jack was deeply involved in a number of traitorous games with the Nazis. The Zionists could be excused for missing this part of Jack's life. Unlike his other activities, he tried to keep that Saudi Nazi connection a deep secret. According to sources on both sides of the Atlantic, it was Philby who advised Ibn Saud energetically to court Nazi Germany in the months before the war. The relationship was mutually beneficial. As one U.S. intelligence study found, the Nazis, quote, recognized that King Ibn Saud's help was essential for renewing the fight against the British and the Jews in Palestine, unquote. The Germans proposed that a new government should be formed in Palestine under the control of Jack's old friend, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Further, quote, Jews who had settled in Palestine after the First World War would not be allowed to remain, unquote. In January of 1939, Saudi Arabia established diplomatic relations with the Third Reich, and Ibn Saud confided to the Germans that at heart he hated the English, unquote. In the following months, he concluded arms deals with Germany and signed a friendship and trade treaty with Japan. Philby was pleased, especially as Ibn Saud concealed his secret dealings with the Axis from both the British and Americans. The Nazis also were pleased with the progress they had made with the king. They sent their best Middle East agent, Fritz Grubba, G-R-O-B-B-A, to meet with Ibn Saud and even promised to obtain for him the most prestigious position in the Muslim world, the Caliphate. The Saudi Third Reich connection flourished, with their main link being their mutual hatred for the Jews. The Nazis even promised to supply Ibn Saud with weapons, ammunition, and an armaments factory, and, according to some accounts, gave him bribes during most of World War II. The king had many reasons for his secret arms deals with Berlin. The primary purpose, quote, was to increase the flow of weapons which Ibn Saud had secretly been sending to the Arabs fighting in Palestine, unquote, in order to check the Zionist influence that had followed the Balfour Declaration, unquote. Although he later claimed to be genuinely horrified by the Nazis' final solution, Ibn Saud's attitude toward the Jews was extreme, even by Arab standards. They were a race accursed by God according to his holy book and destined to final destruction and eternal damnation, unquote. The king's Nazi arms deals were not the end of Philby's war on the Jews. According to some of our sources, Philby had cut yet another deal to keep himself out of prison in Britain as a Nazi sympathizer. Saudi Arabia would stay neutral in the war in return for a bribe. In effect, the king would get paid to pump no oil for either side. 2 years after the Nazis had begun their secret bribes to Ibn Saud, the same shakedown was used on the Americans. In June 1941, just 6 months before the Americans entered the war, one of Ibn Saud's American frontmen, James Moffat of Caltex, went to President Roosevelt for a bribe. To guarantee that Saudi Arabia's oil would not fall into enemy hands, the American government had to hand over $6 million a year to Ibn Saud. As already discussed, Moffat had been forced reluctantly to rid his company of the notorious Nazi agent Torkild Reber under threat of a public scandal. Moffat's covert pro-Hitler stance was now transformed into blackmail of the president. But Roosevelt was not such a simpleton. He turned the matter over to the British. They promptly resumed their subsidy to Ibn Saud so that he would not sell oil to either side. Suddenly, all the Saudi wells were capped temporarily with cement, ostensibly to keep them out of Nazi hands in case Rommel won the battle for North Africa. The Allies might suffer, but at least Hitler would not get the Saudi oil, or so it seemed. A few months later, after Hitler declared war on the United States, President Roosevelt established a Bureau of Economic Warfare. The Middle East section brought up numerous complaints that the American Caltex subsidiary involved in Saudi Arabian oil was still shipping oil to the enemy. The Saudi Nazi scandal just would not die. Not surprisingly, Dulles' cronies in the State Department dragged out the Nazi oil investigation for more than a year. By late 1942, the Dulles brothers had a solution. They used their old friend and investor, Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal, for the brassiest sales pitch of all time. If the United States wanted to assure Caltex's loyalty during the war, it should buy it. Roosevelt thought he already had. The president had surreptitiously increased American lend-lease payments to Churchill in order to fund under-the-table British subsidies to the King of Saudi Arabia. That, Dulles' friends said, was the problem. With the secret help of U.S. money, the British were getting entirely too much influence in Saudi Arabia. There was a real risk that the British might even assassinate Ibn Saud and install an oil puppet of their own. The secret U.S. subsidy should be stopped, and the American government should become an investor in Caltex's Saudi oil operations. It was a matter of the highest national interest. Texaco's James Moffat went once more, quote, to his friend President Roosevelt, unquote, and warned that if the bribe money for Ibn Saud was not coughed up, again quoting, this independent kingdom, and perhaps with it the entire Arab world, will be thrown into chaos, unquote. Moffat seemed to have learned a thing or two about blackmail from Dulles. Quote, as an added inducement for the president's advisors, he pledged annual delivery for the next 5 years of $6 million worth of petroleum to the United States Armed Forces at very low prices. The exact nature of this last feature of the proposal subsequently became a subject of great debate and was a contributing factor leading to a federal suit against the major overseas corporations. Unquote. In the meantime, the president was exactly where Moffat and the others wanted him. in light of the leverage that Dulles, Philby, Moffitt, and the rest of the U.S. oil companies now had over the war effort, it did not take long before they obtained the desired result. In December 1942, Washington dumped the London subsidies and outbid Hitler for Ibn Saud's loyalty. The new U.S. policy was exactly what Dulles' stooges had advocated, quote, "The development of Saudi Arabian petroleum resources should be viewed in the light of the broad national interest," unquote. Roosevelt never could get congressional approval for an official U.S. government investment in what soon evolved into Aramco. Again, that's the Arabian American Oil Company. Continuing, he did the next best thing. Saudi Arabia became the only neutral nation approved for generous lend-lease terms, despite Ibn Saud's notoriously close links with Hitler. Doing so actually required a major policy backflip, but the president pushed it through. In February of 1943, Washington granted Ibn Saud his bribe. Roosevelt wrote to the Lend-Lease Administration, declaring that, quote, "The defense of Saudi Arabia is vital to the defense of the United States," unquote. Much more generous U.S. funding soon replaced London's, quote, "subsidy," unquote. The British Empire was out, and over the next 4 years, Ibn Saud received $100 million. And this complex game between SoCal, Texaco, Standard Oil of New Jersey, I.G. Farben, Adolf Hitler, Jack Philby, Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, people like James Forrestal of Saudi Arabia, this complex game was to result not only, obviously, in treason against the United States by the petroleum companies and Allen and John Foster Dulles. It was to result in the Saudis and Jack Philby playing both ends against the middle and getting paid by both sides while collaborating with both sides. And bear in mind that when Jack Philby and Ibn Saud were playing a similarly Byzantine game with Zionists and Azar Wiseman and the British, while all the time working for Otto von Bolschwing, whose protege Helena von Dahm basically selected all of the personnel from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments, bear in mind that Philby and Saud were similarly in cahoots and really working for Hitler the whole time that they were conning the British and the Zionists. And bear in mind Otto von Bolschwing's central position working in this deal for the Third Reich and his later role with U.S. intelligence and his relationship to Helena von Dahm. Bear in mind also the Bormann Group's acquisition of the Hermann Schmidt's capital participation and I.G. Farben capital participation in not only Standard Oil of New Jersey, in which they owned as much stock as the Rockefellers eventually, but also SoCal. And bear in mind that this Byzantine relationship that we've just discussed ultimately was to result in the present-day structure of not only the oil business or the oil business of Saudi Arabia, but of much of the Middle East as well. And bear in mind, too, as gas prices soar in the spring of the year 2000, bear in mind that George W. Bush and his family, George Herbert Walker Bush, have very, very long-standing connections to this milieu, as discussed in For the Record program 186. Spitfire, the tape duplication service I alluded to earlier, can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Website spitfirelist.com. That concludes this program. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening to For the Record program 216.